All right, we're continuing in 1 Corinthians 7, and like we've said, Paul is really focusing on a certain aspect of marriage here, and especially more on the negative side, and just the answer it is to sexual immorality and the danger and pervasiveness of that sin that he's already covered, and that's flowed into this. And I just wanted to touch on a few passages to show the other side of it. Of course, marriage is God's plan, and it is a huge blessing. And go back to Genesis chapter 2. We find in the initial creation, we find that to be the case so clearly here. And we have the first surgery to ever be performed, and divine anesthetic, evidently. I would take it there'd be no pain here in that pre-fall state. But takes the rib in verse 21 of chapter 2, fashioned a woman. And really, again, both the man and the woman unique. You know, he speaks the rest of creation into existence here. He directly involved with forming the man and the woman. And then the man declares, verse 23, "This is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she has been taken out of man. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." So you see the beauty of this creation, the beauty of this relationship that God has made, and the intimacy, you know, even superseding father and mother, which is obviously a very close bond, as God has designed it. And yet now that being superseded by the wife and the husband coming together, leaving the father and mother, and then being together and both naked yet not ashamed. And the union of that relationship and the sexual relationship, and there's no shame in that. There's nothing wrong with it. It's a beautiful, wonderful thing. Then go over to the Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon. And we find, and some have tried to say this is a picture only of Christ in the church, and I think that's impossible to fit here. Obviously, there is overlap because Paul highlights strongly Ephesians 5 that the marriage relationship is to picture Christ in the church. And the love and the connection, obviously the submission of the wife, the loving leadership of the husband is to portray that relationship in a beautiful and special way. But obviously in Solomon, the focus is the wonder of this relationship, marriage relationship, and the sexual relationship, the joy and the pleasure and all that God's done in this relationship. And it's really impossible to me to see this differently, misconstrued. You have to be super figurative, I guess, to make it say that. And obviously it's not the most comfortable book to read or to talk about, study, because of the relationship, the sexual relationship, and that being the focus. But again, it highlights just what that relationship can be and God intends it to be, that it's intended to be a tremendous blessing, a great joy. Right off the bat, Song of Songs, which is Solomon's, verse 1, "May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Your oils have a pleasing fragrance. Your name is like purified oil. Therefore, the maidens love you. Draw me after you and let us run together. The king has brought me into his chambers. We will rejoice in you and be glad. We will extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you." And she goes on, speaks of her appearance. Maybe some concern there. Not surprising. As women being more sensitive and more focused on that. But jumping down to verse 8, "If you yourself do not know, most beautiful among women, go forth on the trail of the flock and pasture your goats by the tents of the shepherd. To me, my darling, you're like my mare among the chariots of Pharaoh." And we have some interesting comparisons that evidently, obviously, were amazing back then. And probably have to be in those situations to fully comprehend that, but my mare among the chariots of Pharaoh, your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with string of beads. We will make for you ornaments of gold with beads of silver. While the king was at his table, my perfume gave forth its fragrance. My beloved is to me a pouch of myrrh, which lies all night between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms. You know, just again, on and on and on. Verse 15, how beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves. How handsome you are, my beloved. So pleasant. I mean, again, I just don't know how in the world you make this only Christ in the church. It's clearly exalting this wonderful and beautiful relationship. And it'll go on to talk about problems with that relationship too. And we'll talk about this back in 1 Corinthians. But it just does show what God intends here. And of course, sin's the problem. Sin is always the problem, not the design. And just as the world wants to attack, you know, the husband being the leader, the wife submitting, that's God's perfect design. But it's sin that messes it up. It's our sin. It's our evil that hurts it or even destroys it. And that would be no different with this, the blessing of this. So just wanted to highlight that briefly to remind us of the fullness of God's design. And it's not Paul's intent to bring that in or give that balance in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. We're going to see him continuing not only to highlight the responsibility of this, but also continue to highlight the blessing of singleness. And as he would see it, the greater gift of singleness. And so if you only read 1 Corinthians 7, then you wouldn't get that fullness, that full picture. And as we mentioned, Ephesians 5 as well, he writes later on and does give that greater emphasis even in that passage. His goal in this passage is to deal with the pervasiveness of sexual sin in the Corinthian, we know from history, in their city, and have that also, of course, as a result, being a major struggle in the body. And so that's really been his focus in chapter 6 towards the end, and now in chapter 7 continues then to highlight, with that being such a struggle, if you're able to be single or stay single, then that's the better route because of all of that. But he also is going to indicate, you know, I understand that everyone can't do that, and we know, at least in our time in the church, it's more the minority that would be staying single and the majority who would end up being married as a result. So just wanting to put this in perspective and realize this is written for a specific purpose with a specific goal and drive, and Paul's not intending to give us the full picture, and we have that in different ways in Scripture at different times. So it's always helpful to remember that and therefore not come away with the wrong thinking or idea from this passage. Any questions about that or thoughts? But helpful to see that and see the greater picture of what God's designed from the start and what that can be or has been in good and godly marriages. We'll jump back into chapter 7 then, and after really saying each man is to have, because of the sin of sexual immorality and the struggle pervasiveness of that, each man is to have his own wife, each woman is to have her own husband, and again highlighting the one man, one woman relationship and all the perversion in our day and age that has completely in the world rejected this, and the church struggles and starts to fudge with that pressure building, continuing to be stronger and stronger. And yet the scriptures are very clear. That is what's right. That is the plan. And that is the only place the sexual relationship is a blessing and is given to partake of. And so Paul is, of course, highlighting that each man is to have his own wife and each woman is to have her own husband. And so that's ultimately what we're to be committed to and what we're to strive for. Even as I do marriage counseling, it's a major emphasis that I make in that is to really go back to the other passages and then even to look at divorce and how God sees divorce and the danger of that, just to fix in our minds. Again, we live in a culture, we live in a world where, I mean, in my lifetime, it went from that was the standard to that is repudiated. That is, laughed at and joked about openly. And so as believers, we have to know that and even more commit ourselves that that's what we are committed to. And knowing and not letting that start to weaken or make our understanding fuzzy on that. But even as we either look to be married and approach that, knowing we need to find obviously a clear growing believer, but also one who understands and has that same commitment. Lest we get into a relationship and all of a sudden, then the other person isn't so committed to that or doesn't have that same understanding. And we'll talk about this with the sexual relationship, but two sinners, there's problems. You know, the best relationship, the strongest marriage, is going to have struggle, going to have tremendous struggle at times. It's unavoidable this side of heaven. I can't wait to see perfect marriages if I think they'll happen in the eternal state, and mostly perfect in the kingdom because open sin won't be tolerated, but it'll be a wonderful, beautiful thing. But that's not the way it is now. That's not the way we have it now. It's imperfect. And because we're sinners, then there's going to be struggles. So this has to be, just fixed and strong and unwavering in our minds so that in the midst of struggle and difficulty, we should not even entertain this. We should not even think this, allow this thought to be in our mind, nor should we ever say it as a threat or, in anger or frustration. And again, I fear that there's more struggle because the world, just has completely rejected this. In my lifetime, it has completely turned around. And therefore, we need to keep that in mind. And Paul again starts by highlighting this, that this is the way it should be or needs to be. And praise God. It's, obviously, again, everything that God does is perfect, isn't it? God never, we need to have marriage 2.0 because I forgot, I made some mistakes there. I didn't see. That's the ludicrousness of psychology in the world trying to correct or change what God said. Like, he messed it up, really? You think he actually somehow got it wrong? It's just the height of arrogance, the height of foolishness to think that somehow we can make it better or it needs to be corrected. And so we know that in spite of sin and the struggles, God's design is perfect. And the longer you're married, the more you understand that and see that because your love deepens and you're really, there's a sorrow about those who do bail out, those who do not continue on. And again, we can be forgiven and often saved even after the fact and all those things. But the longer you're married and the deeper your love grows, and you persevere through the hard things, there is a greater blessing and a greater love and joy that comes over time. And praise God for that. Praise God for that. And that's part of that perfect design. God knew that. He knew that there would, years and decades and on it goes and the blessing of that, that he brings. So again, it's based on this perfect design. It's based on an all-wise design. And, even like with something like election, at times I've had people say, especially my second church, the previous pastor evidently had pounded that doctrine hard. And the people said, well, we know it's biblical, but we don't like it. We know it's biblical, but we don't like it. I'm like, wait a second. You should never not like what God does. Something's wrong with you. You're thinking my thinking. If we think that I don't like it, then wait a second. We need to think some more. We need to study some more. We're not where we should be. And so it's just such a joy as we study scripture, we learn God's plan to know that absolutely and never need to doubt that. We should never, give in to temptation to think, oh, maybe this is better. Maybe, we deal with something like hell and things that are more difficult. It's so good to know I don't fully understand everything. I can't fully explain it, but I know God is perfect. I know that God never does anything wrong, and therefore I can rest in it. In fact, in Romans 9, that's really what Paul says about election. He says God can, it's impossible for God to be unjust. It's not something he could ever do. And then he, of course, finally says, you're no match for God. You're not on his level, so be quiet. You know, don't challenge him. That's never a good idea. And that's true for anything that God does or says. But what a joy we have to know him, to have that confidence, and therefore, as we study his word, to rejoice in whatever he does. Whatever he says is right or good, we can know is true. And certainly that's the case for marriage. And even, you know, as we've alluded to, the fact that it does portray, as we grow in it and we live more godly in it, it does portray Christ in the church. And no matter where we're at in it, we can progress and more show that love and that beautiful picture. And that's part of what God's designed for sure. But we saw last time in verse 3, this command to fulfill our duty. The husband is to fulfill his duty to his wife and likewise also the wife to her husband. And I think, again, in the conditions they were in and also knowing the reality of sin that we still have, that he was compelled to write this to say, look, you know, it's not all a bed of roses. You don't just live happily ever after. That's in the movies. That's in a book. That's not real life. And this is part of the problem. The world wants to portray even the sexual relationship as just something that's automatic, something that is just wonderful, something that is, you know, this passion, and it just all works out great. It's just a lie. It's a big lie. As with the rest of the marriage relationship, it has difficulties. There are challenges. You have to work at it. You grow in it. And it becomes more pleasing and more joyful, but then there's struggles that can happen. So Paul knows that, not by experience, evidently. It would seem that he's always been single, but perhaps by God guiding him or talking to husbands and wives or knowing the sinful condition of men. This isn't going to be automatic or just easy. And so he's saying there is a debt here. That's the word, duty. There's a debt that you owe when you enter into the marriage relationship to your spouse, and particularly in this area, the physical relationship, sex, there is a responsibility. And so we need to understand that and know that as we are taking the vows and we are committing to each other, that that is the case, and therefore I'm going to fulfill that even when it's difficult, I really don't feel like it or want to, but God has commanded and made it clear, and therefore I'm going to obey him. It's interesting that Paul doesn't just make the statement in verse 3. You would think that's enough. Verse 3, it's a debt. Fulfill your debt, and likewise the wife to the husband. Okay, we got it. We can move on. But he doesn't stop there. He gives us verse 4 to push it even further and emphasize it even in a greater way. And so here he says the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. And it really highlights the command, and the goal is to please your mate and realize your body, you're giving your body over to them when you marry. And therefore, you're wanting to please them with your body. And again, it really has a even stronger drive for how important it is to not relent or think that you can turn away from and decide, I just don't want to have this sexual relationship anymore, so I'm just not going to. That is not an option. Yes, there are struggles. Yes, there are challenges. But the reality is this is a duty that you agreed to and you gave authority over your body to your mate. And of course it can swing in different ways, and different, either partner can at times be more or less excited, more or less wanting that relationship. But when we understand this, it really gets rid of a lot of excuses and definitely takes away that option, if you will, or that possibility of saying, I'm not going to do this anymore, or I just don't like it, whatever the case. Again, it's something to talk about. It's something to work through when there are struggles, when things aren't going well, knowing that this is the case. The option is not just to stop and we just don't pursue it. That's not an option. And it really, as we're going to see in verse 5, you're setting your marriage up for destruction if you do that. And even where someone, you know, has a job or profession that takes them away for long periods of time, which I think you want to be awfully careful about getting into, you really want to, you're going to have to work harder to make sure. I mean, whether it's you take the family with you, to some extent, or whatever it is to compensate, it becomes more challenging. Whether it's a professional athlete or someone who works in travel, it's easy then to all of a sudden be gone for weeks, and that just causes a lot of problems in this area particularly, and starts to, instead of this being the bonding agent that it's intended to be, as Paul highlighted in chapter 6, in the sin of it, it starts to weaken and fall apart, and the marriage can disintegrate incredibly, you know, quickly when temptation comes. And that's what verse 5 is going to talk about. We'll talk more about that. But again, I think just the way he's saying this does bring this strong emphasis of how important this is, and that we must, again, if we are going to go into the marriage relationship, then this has to be our mindset. This has to be what we're committed to. Otherwise, don't enter into the relationship. Don't do this. This is what God has said and commanded. Any thoughts or questions about that? Yeah, Terry.
Yeah. One of the things that comes up a lot of times as people get older, and, you know, people have different diseases, disabilities.
Sure.
And they have to deal with that. If one of the spouses has, like, some type of debilitating thing where they can't have sex anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those things do happen. And,
they
do.
They,
that's a situation, too, that, you know, that the spouse, the one that gets the disease or whatever, may, you know, feel really bad about it, you know, and the other one, of course, you know, is being left in the situation where, you know, Satan can be tempting that person. And, you know, there's a lot of situations like that as people get older, too.
Sure.
And sometimes even with younger people, people, you know, get into accidents and different things happen, you know, in life that, do that.
Sure.
I know it doesn't deal independently with any of those things.
Yeah.
I know his main intent is, as a whole in general here, what he's saying, but...
Right.
But yeah, you know, those things can be really tough on a marriage sometimes.
Very much so.
Yeah.
You know, I would say they're the exception versus the rule, as you're saying.
Right.
You know, they're not the mainstream, but they can happen or do happen.
Yeah.
And obviously then that becomes, you know, you're going to lean on God for that grace to go through that and be faithful in spite of that huge, you know, what might say stumbling block or obstacle that's going to really make it more difficult in the marriage for sure.
Yeah, I've known of marriages to break up over just that.
Sure.
What I said, I'm not one.
Yeah.
I didn't marry this person to tend to them with disabilities their life. And, and so they want somebody different, you know. And it's, it's really sad. But,
And they kind of forget that. And it's not as common that it's used, I don't think, in the marriage vows anymore, but in sickness and in health, in until death do us part. You're committing to whatever happens, whatever the other person does experience or whatever, you know, accident or disease or whatever, like you're saying, that happens. And that becomes a huge test. As believers, thankfully, we have God to turn to and each other to, you know, for encouragement and strength to continue on and to accept that challenge or that change, huge change and difference. So yeah, those things obviously can happen. And then you look to the Lord and fellow believers for wisdom and guidance to walk through that and continue to be faithful, in those situations for sure. And it's a huge test. I mean, it becomes a huge test of commitment and love. And you see the world, like you're saying, unbelievers at times will just abandon ship, you know. The wife husband gets cancer, you know, that seems terminal, and they'll be out the door. And those things as well highlight the vital importance to make sure you're marrying a true believer and someone who really is growing, not just claiming to be a believer, but is growing. And you can see the evidence. There's a track record, because these things can happen. I mean, you can lose a child, obviously, have a stillborn, or even a child gets killed. Those are huge, traumatic things in life. And if you're not married to a believer, guess what? You don't have a very strong assurance you're going to make it through that. Your marriage is going to make it through. It's hard enough for two believers and the grace of God, but when you don't have it, then the possibility of it blowing up your marriage is even greater. And so I think some of those exceptions we do talk about or know happen, it's just a reminder to make sure when you're making that choice, praying diligently, you know, really knowing this person well, seeking advice from other godly people to make a good and wise decision because of how serious the relationship is. I mean, because it is for life. If you know me very well, you know, I've always in my life, I take things back that I don't like, you know, I return them. love that 90-day return policy at Walmart or whatever, and I've taken full advantage. But marriage is just not that way. There is no return policy. Once, you know, that commitment's made, then you are for life committed. So it's just making that decision well, not knowing what God has in store, not knowing what may or may not happen in the relationship. But at the same time, knowing God will give you the grace, whatever it does. God will give you the strength, no matter how difficult the circumstance. And really, 2 Corinthians 12, Paul talks about the thorn of the flesh and crying out to God that it be taken away. And God says, no, my grace is sufficient for you, and power is perfected in weakness. You know, I'm going to show my greatness through this weakness I've allowed you to have. And Paul even says, well, then I'll boast. If I know God's being glorified, I'll boast in it even, which I don't know that I'm that far yet, but he is willing to see it as such a good thing because God's going to be glorified. So it's a great point, Terry, that can happen, and dealing with that way. And that really leads us to verse 5, stop depriving one another except by agreement for a time. And, you know, so the temptation, and there can just be a variety of things or situations that can lead to this, disputes and disagreements and arguments and using even sex as a way to get what you want, and threaten to withhold it. He's saying, don't do this. Do not deprive one another. And it's interesting, the one exception that he gives. And I think there would be other things. He doesn't choose to try to go into other things that might arise to hinder this. Sickness, certainly, even pregnancy and its challenges will have an effect. He doesn't choose to go into those things. But here, you know, he's saying, don't deprive one another. Don't choose to withhold this is the issue, and not fulfill, pay your debt, so to speak, or fulfill using your body for the pleasure of your spouse because they have authority over your body. Stop doing that except by agreement for a time. So even when there's an agreement, it's not going to be ongoing or indefinite. If there's an agreement, it should be for a specific time so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. And it's interesting that how much that would highlight the importance of prayer and our devotion to prayer, that that would be the one exception. We need to pray so much about something in our lives that we would not have the sexual relationship for a week or 2 weeks or whatever. And we're going to pray more. So it really highlights prayer here. It's interesting that he doesn't include fasting. And that thought of fasting, should we fast? And some believers do, and really highlight it strongly. I don't see any emphasis on fasting in the New Testament. There's some in the Gospels, but really in the New Testament, I don't see any there. In fact, I don't know if it's mentioned once or twice. It's rarely mentioned even. But here he doesn't give that as a reason, which you would think would be another one if it's something that we would be focused on or should consider doing or would be doing. He doesn't bring it up. And I think it primarily is an Old Testament, just like some other things in the Old Testament. Fasting was a sign of repentance. It was a means of demonstrating to God outwardly that you were repentant, and the nation was even commanded to fast and put on sackcloth and ashes. And again, those things have fallen away in the New Testament. I don't think that they're things that we're commanded or really urged to do. In fact, we're told not to, you know, observe ceremonies and Sabbaths. And I think fasting, in my mind, tends to go into that category. That's a whole other subject. We won't go down that trail very far, but I just think it's interesting he doesn't say it here. Yeah, Stephen.
I know at least in two versions, it actually is a fasting prayer that's been supposed to.
Which versions are they?
Mm-hmm. The King James and the New King James.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe there would be some manuscript that they would see. I wonder why the NS didn't, though, because usually they're pretty close. So I don't know if the Dead Sea Scrolls or what it was that more manuscripts had them take it away. That's
right,
interesting.
Yeah. Maybe there's additional manuscripts that, you
know, yeah, to, sure. Yeah. Again, the challenge is it's just so rarely mentioned in the New Testament. It's just not something that's really focused on in the epistles. I'm saying epistles, I shouldn't be more specific. It's in the Gospels, clearly. But that's still under the Old Testament, versus then in the epistles you don't really see that much.
MacArthur's got it in his commentary in his Bible.
A fasting?
Fasting.
He sees it as...
A prayer, it says fasting.
In the new version, or...?
Well, he's got prayer in the written part, but when you go down to the comments, he's mm-hmm. got fasting.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. That's interesting that would be put in there. But again, I guess it depends. There evidently is some manuscript
evidence. It says, so for intercession as part of their fasting, come together again.
Mm-hmm.
Does he talk about fasting?
Does he say why he includes?
Maybe talk about fasting of sexual contact.
That's the kind of fasting he's talking about, or versus fasting from food?
Yeah.
Okay.
That might be what he's talking about.
Maybe so. Yeah, that would make more sense. Unless he went into the textual reason that he might be adding it, that would make more sense that he's saying fasting from sexual relationships, for sure. So, but anyway, it's clearly, you know, this one exception, and that this would be rare, but it also is by agreement. So, you know, can't be unilateral. Somewhat, one of the spouses saying, oh, I need this time, I need to do this, I'm not going to have these relationships with you for the next 2 weeks. It has to be by agreement. Again, the parity here is really strong. That even though we know that the husband is the leader and the wife is to submit, in this area, there is great parity being emphasized throughout these verses, isn't there? So, you know, he said already that each man is to have his own wife, each woman is to have her own husband. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, so he went to great lengths to make this, you know, on both sides, an equal responsibility, and not being more on one than the other. And perhaps historically it's been more focused on the wife and her responsibility, but that's not the case. It's both sides here. are strongly emphasized. I think verse 5 puts an exclamation point, by agreement. It has to be by agreement for a time. And so there would be that potential or possibility, but only for a time. And notice what he says at the end then, the command, come back together so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So again, this is God's primary answer to the struggle, the temptations to sexual sin, and marriage, obviously, being that answer and that relationship in marriage. And so here he warns specifically that even when there's this exception of an agreement for a time, that then you, at the end of that time, come back together and partake again of this relationship so that Satan would not tempt you. And I think, again, this is so clear in even different public situations where marriages fall apart and the husband and wife are away from each other for long periods of time. And really to work to prevent that, to do whatever you can to not let that happen, knowing Satan is alive and well, knowing that he's attacking, knowing this is an area he will attack and does attack. And I think I mentioned a few weeks ago, I think it was a movie star saying he and his wife had agreed never to be apart more than 2 days, you know, physically apart, separated physically, let alone in this area. And how wise, how, you know, what a good decision to prevent then this relationship being affected, which it would, and then to allow, and I don't know that they were believers or not, but clearly Satan has done this throughout the ages, and men and women, husbands and wives have foolishly thought we're fine or we can be fine and it won't affect our relationship to be apart for lengthy periods and obviously then be not enjoying this relationship, and yet it does, and their marriage breaks down and is then destroyed, often destroyed. So even Paul, I think later on, either in Corinthians, you know, we're not ignorant of Satan's, I think it may be in 2 Corinthians, of Satan's devices or Satan's schemes. This is clearly a scheme we should not be ignorant of. We should not know this. And therefore, if we are married, then we're going to keep that relationship a strong priority and be careful not to be apart regularly, or at least not for long periods of time with any regularity, knowing that this is the case. So again, some really strong warnings here, strong challenge to take to heart, especially for those who are married and those who would eventually be married. This is important. This is critical. And it really lays down the reality and clear responsibility in this area in marriage, and why it's so important then to do this. Why does it matter? Again, it's meant to be a bonding agent. It's meant to cement you together, and it does a great job of that. But if you allow other things to affect it and stop it, then you're breaking that bond. You're letting that bond start to get weaker and eventually be broken more easily, and Satan knows that, and he's going to attack it in different ways to try to harm you. So any final thoughts or questions about this section? We'll leave verse 6 for next time. What is the concession? He said, doesn't seem like a lot of this is concession. But we'll talk about what he means by concession here.